something heard, and I'd like to see if there are any mobile stations, perhaps, who would like to check into this Mara Sentinel net. If you're out there, Mobile, and would like to identify, please come down with your call sign and your name. Okay, then I don't have a breakdown of the call sign, so space out your calls as they come in. Anybody out there who would like to check into the technical net that's home listening and looking for Gordon? Unfortunately, this is Tony, K2A in line. But this is K2BAR net. If you're out there, please come now with your call sign and your name.
K2BAR. Kilo 2 Delta Echo November.
Okay, and K2DEN, which is Denver. Thank you for checking in. Anybody else?
This is W2JEK, Don. No question.
Don, thank you for reminding me that if you have a question, please mention that you do have a question or a comment. Anybody else wishing to check in, please now. Please come now. TC2QYM, are you going to be hanging around for the net?
Tony, not for the entire time. I just had a quick question, which is why I popped in. So there is a question, so I'll ask it when my time comes around, and unless you want me to ask it right now.
Brian, we'll make you your number one for questions, so we'll be right back to you if there's nobody else. But if anybody else out there listening who would like to identify, please come now with your call sign. So we do have KC2QYM. I'm sorry, I can't come up with your name. Please back with your name and your question.
Okay, KC2QYM. Good evening, Tony. This is Peter, and hello, Denver and Don. I had a question, Tony, about antenna droop, wire antenna droops. I had a problem with my antenna recently, my HF antenna. I only use one wire, as you may recall, and I have a second tree that supports the wire in mid-level. Well, last week when we had some heavy rain and quick wind, the tree fell down. And what I did is I used an old 10-meter vertical that I had as a mast support for my antenna. When I put that up to support the rest of the wire, I noticed that I had a droop because I guess the wire dripped down below some of the points or the other boughs of the tree, so I have some slack. I'm just going to drop it and reset. I got some slack in the antenna, so from my window going out to the tree, the wire basically droops from a horizontal about 2 or 3 feet. My first question is, does a significant amount of droop, or how significant does the droop have to be to have any impact on radiation patterns? And number two, does the proximity of the vertical aluminum antenna, which I'm just using as a mast to support the wire, have any impact or absorption or anything else on the RF? I'll pose that question to you or anybody else on the net that may want to answer it. KC2QYM, back to net.
Let's see if anybody on frequency would like to make a comment about that. Anybody wishing to get back to Peter, please come now with your call, your name.
W2JEK, Don.
Hey, Don, what do you got to say about that?
Yeah, I really don't think it's going to affect you much, that 10-meter mast. What I have I've done here in the past, I've had a 40-meter dipole that ran from the TV antenna mast, which is on the top of my house attached to the chimney, ran out across the yard to the limb of a cherry tree. And when it got out there, after 66 feet of antenna, then I hooked up a piece of rope that went through a pulley. And that pulley had a half a cinder block attached to it. Now, that pulley was attached to another rope that went over the branch of this cherry tree that I had in the corner of the yard. So if the wind blew the cherry tree, the cinder block just went up and down, and it did not caused the antenna to snap. As what had happened once, before I did that, the TV mast actually bent because the wind pulled it. So that's when I got the pulley up there. But maybe something like that, if you could use that with enough weight on it, just to, first of all, it prevents the tree from breaking your antenna. Secondly, it might take enough strain on it to hold it up at a more horizontal position. So that's something to think about, Pete. Back to W2JK.
Okay, yeah. You follow that, Peter, and would you like to make any comments or questions to Don about that?
Yeah, hi, Don. Thank you very much for your response. KC2QIM back. So you're thinking, okay, so actually what I have is I have almost three trees. I have an end-fed wire, so it comes out of the window. It's supported at the window frame, goes across to the first tree. What I did is I threw it up into the boughs of the trees up there. So it's actually just resting on top of the bough of the tree. And then it had gone to a second tree. That tree fell down, and I used the 10-meter mast to put it up about 25 feet. Well, the 10-meter antenna, actually, the vertical is acting as a mast. I actually pumped it into the ground. And then I put an insulated line on hook on the end of the top of the mast of the antenna to support the wire. So I basically looped the wire through that piece of plastic, and that's supported there at the second point. And the third point is tied off to a tree with an insulator, etc. So, but I did find that I had some slack. So the droop or the slack actually creates a very interesting situation. I'm only using 18-gauge wire. The wire itself, about 102 feet. It's very light, and it really has no weight to really cascade or push anything down. It's just a question of I've gotten more droop in it than I had before. So you'd think that the droop doesn't have any real impact, and the proximity to the aluminum vertical antenna, even though it's isolated from it, shouldn't have any impact on my radiation pattern either. Roger.
W2JK.
Don, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I don't know how high this is, but it's depending what band, actually. Now, if you're talking about 40 meters, halfway, so the ideal thing, you see these pictures in the book, 40-meter dipole, a halfway up, at 66 feet up in the air, then you see this beautiful pattern of it going, the angle of radiation going out at about a 33-degree angle. But most of us can't get 40-meter dipole up that high, and the 40-meter dipole looks like it's shooting most of its energy straight up. What they call NVIS, near vertical incident signal. However, depending on where you're located, if you're on a hill or something, top of a hill maybe, you may find that beneficial. I'd say use the thing as you have it, and compare results. And like I say, if you should have some way possibly to think about preventing it from being pulled toward if the trees blow too much, then that could break the wire, and then you'd have to go hassling a hassle and put that again, putting it up again. However, like I say, use a pulley and a cinder block at the one end. That would take, I mean, none of the cinder block is just going to go up and down, and when the tree bends. So this is just as a safety thing for you, so you're not going to be having the wire break on you when blows the trees. But I'd say if it's up fairly high enough to, let's say, 20 feet or so, you'll be doing all right, I think, especially a little bit of slack probably wouldn't matter that much. Just go ahead and work with it. I think you'll be fine. This is, in fact, might go out only on it. But back to that, W2JK.
Thank you, Don. And I think probably Peter follows most of that. I agree also with the second supporter of what Don commented, and that is that a little bit of a droop, 2 or 3 foot of droop will make a darn bit of difference in what you will notice. we're calculating this with an antenna radiation pattern program, you might find that it makes a little bit of a difference, but you'll never notice it with what your reception is. It's the direction of the wire and the frequency that you're on, all those things that affect your reception. Now, concerning about that 10-meter vertical antenna used for a support system, again, I am sure that, as you said, you're insulated from the top of that 10-meter antenna to your otherwise long wire antenna, so there is no direct DC or electrical contact between the two. But that 10-meter antenna, just like any 10-meter length of wire, it's an antenna that was resonant at one time, was transmitting, but now it's receiving. But it would make a little of a difference. If that was a transmitting signal, it might make a difference. Right now you have a grounded, vertical, 10-meter rod sitting in the air, and it will be resonant to something in the 10-meter band, and maybe multiples of that, but it should not affect your receiving or your transmitting machines at all. If it saps any energy away from it, it would not be a factor in your overall operation, for sure. So Don says, go ahead and use it. There are a lot worse antennas than that, and they work. Back to you, Peter.
Okay, Don. Okay, Tony. That's great. Thank you very much. I just wanted to get a sort of a blessing from the more experienced amateur radio operators this evening. KC2QIM back. Just for your information, I did work Georgia, not the state of Georgia, but the country of Georgia on 40 meters just prior to me coming on the net. So it was working, and I made the decent contact. Over.
Anything is possible. Much more important factors are, as you realize, propagation conditions and direction of the antenna, than your actual antenna. And I'm sure if you speak to people who use various forms of antennas over the years, they've been successful to some extent without being perfect in their construction. So go ahead and use it.
Okay, well, this antenna was my original antenna that I had up when I got my license back in 07. It never really fell down, even when that second tree fell down. The antenna, even though it was down, didn't hit the ground. I mean, the tree fell down around it, and it was just sitting out there drooping. So I said, I got to do something. And my old buddy, Ron, WB2GAI, had given me an old Cushcraft Ringo antenna, I guess. And I wasn't about to mount it. I had it in storage. And I said, gee, I got to find some way to support this antenna, this wire. So I used it. I called him, and I told him I used it. He says, well, at least it got you on the air. You know, that's fine. And by the way, he's supposed to go to, just as an aside, he's going to Crete, if you're not aware of that. He's going to be QRV in Crete for, I think, a week or so. He's leaving at the end of this month. I'm not sure if he made it to the meeting. He's been, he had a problem with his foot or something. I couldn't make it to the last meeting. I'm not sure if he made it himself. Anyway, back to Ned. No more questions. I'll listen in. K2BAR, KC2QIM.
Very good. Yes, I understand Ron is going to Crete. I think it's more than a week. Unfortunately, he only operates CW. He will be operating from Crete with a call sign that gets related to Crete call sign. I don't know what that call sign is, but somebody will have the information if we really need it. But if you're operating in the CW band, and I think it's more than a week, it might be as long as a month, but I'm not sure. And he should be leaving shortly. Okay. Anybody else with comments or questions? Don, do you have any input for today?
W2JEK, yes, Tony. Ron was at the kit night Tuesday, and he's going to be using SV9, Sugar Vector 9 / WV2GAI. So, in other words, the American call with a / SV9 in front of it. And he will be working split and try around 5 kilohertz up. Just send your call a couple times and see if he comes back to you. It's about the size of it. He does get some pretty good pilots once in a while. One of the reasons he does use QRP is that he will be pulled down the size of the pilot that way. That's what he's saying. Well, that's one I have to put. One perfect lease I haven't gotten yet, so I have to work with this before. Back to net, W2JK.
Thank you very much, Don. I probably won't even try. But I don't know, those who are anxious to go ahead. How about Denver? Denver, what's happening in your world there? K2, KEN, I like to do both lines, but go ahead.
There's not a lot happening over here, but I'm hoping to make it to coffee tomorrow morning so that I can schedule some time for everybody to come over and help me raise my antenna we made on kid night. I don't think you were there, Tony, but we made a... pulling a blank out his name right now, but we made a really nice antenna, and I got some coax and some rope. I'm just about ready to put up a antenna. I remember his name is Larry. He got me a bunch of antenna supplies and a bunch of stuff to put up an antenna, and that's tuned for I think 20 meters. That was it. It was just a little bit below, but then again, we had people standing around it when we put the antenna analyzer on it. And I have a radio, I've got a power supply, so all I need is an antenna up and I'll be on the air.
Hey, I also plan to get to coffee tomorrow, so maybe we'll coordinate something along with you or other. Anybody else can help us, or I'll be willing to help anybody. I can fly a device that will throw a projectile over a tree if necessary, other than a bow and arrow, I'll get a slingshot, and I have my pneumatic. Which right now Noel is using it to say the truth. Noel is looking on his antenna. He's got my equipment over his house, but let's see what you can get. Okay, Denver, very good. Anybody else out there listening who would like to check into the K2BAR almost technical mess here tonight? This is Tony K2AMI, but use the call sign K2BAR to check in. Much more hurry, but bear in mind this Saturday is the Oakland Ham Fest. The Oakland Ham Fest is up in Oakland. It's you go up Route 208, I think it's Skyline Drive. That's the first exit in Oakland. Get off that exit, make a left turn, go through most of the city of Oakland, most of the little town of Oakland. You go over the only railroad track that crosses the main street. And maybe yesterday a railroad track, look for Oak Street. I think there's a traffic light on Oak Street, but I'm not sure. Anyway, it's across the street from a supermarket, might be a shop right in the market. And look for a right turn on that corner called Oak Street. Go to the end of Oak Street, you'll find the VFW Hall. There's a long driveway and a back parking lot. Not a very big ham fest. Admission charge $25. Starts at 8 p.m. Right now, the weather forecast is for a nice day on Saturday, so if you are interested in ham festing, come on up to the open ham fest on Saturday. Sunday, there's one down in South Jersey, and quite honestly, I can't be going to South Jersey on a nice Sunday morning, because I know you're going to run into a lot of traffic. So it's quite a ways down. It's probably down around exit 105 or 107, something like that. Like Asbury Park or something like that. You can find directions on the ARL webpage if you wish. Okay, and of course, don't forget our Barra Ham Fest coming up on October the 10th. Also, there is a concern about the next Barra meeting, which will be the first Sunday in September. And the first Sunday in September will be September the 6th. That happens to be the Sunday in Labor Day weekend. So don't think it's going to be canceled because of the holiday, because it won't be canceled. we've been running meetings on holiday weekends, and it's not a big factor. Let me drop it. The following weekend, October 12th and 13th, is the VHF contest weekend. At this point, we have not had a very good turnout for people who say they can make the get something. Doesn't work out, we might not have it. We need to be some dozen people that can promise to be there and put up and cool down some operating time. So let's see what develops. We'll have one last shot at the next Barra meeting, and the following weekend is the contest. So let's see what happens on that. All right. Anybody wish to make any comments or inquiries or information, please come down with your call.
72 JEK with a question.
Don, go ahead.
Yeah, there's some talk that Gene KJI, K2KJI, had a stroke, and then I heard something that it was unfounded, but what is the story on that, over?
The rumor is unfounded. Gene is fine, and he's healthy. And curiously enough, if you saw today's Bergen record over at the Caldwell Airport, which is only a mile or so away from Gene's tour, they're going to have a B-17 come in for both Friday, Saturday, and Sunday this weekend. And if you'd like to visit the B-17, it's not the usual one that goes to Peterborough. It's a different group of the different B-17. If you plan on going to see Gene, and also maybe seeing the B-17 at the Caldwell Airport, which is not too far from where Gene stores.
I think it's $400 a ride. I saw that article in the paper.
They're going twice. I told the story last year. I was there late on Sunday, and they were looking for a few more passengers to go up on the last ride they were going to do on that Sunday. And I was thinking about it, except the ride before that was loading, getting ready to take off. And they kicked over engine number one and kicked right over, and engine number two and kicked over. But on the other side, engine number three wouldn't start. It was backfiring and blowing out smoke. And finally, they got it started. And I decided not to go up on the airplane.
KC2QYM comment.
Okay, very good, Peter. Go ahead.
You know, I think it was last year and also the year before, on a Saturday or Sunday morning, I forgot it, I knew it was a weekend, I was walking along in Tenafly here, and I heard a very unusual sound. It was in the morning, about maybe 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning, maybe 9:30, I don't recall exactly, but it was early enough in the morning. It was quiet, and I hear a rumbling sound off in the distance, and I say to myself, or I was thinking to myself, you know, that doesn't sound like the normal sound that you normally hear up in aircraft traffic. And the reason I have this is because I was in the Navy, I was in the air wing of the Navy, and there were all kinds of different planes and such, and I sort of had my ear perked to things. And I said, something unusual is coming over the tree line. And sure enough, I looked up, and not more than 1,500 feet up or less was a beautiful B-17 rumbling along with monstrous engines. And I tell you what a thrill I got. And then the following year, a similar situation occurred. And of course, then I found out later on that there were all kinds of air shows. Peterborough participated, and they had these rides and stuff. But it's just so magnificent to see those things up in the air and still flying. I'm always so mesmerized by it. And that's my comment. Back to Ned.
Yeah, I get the same thrill too, and I can recognize that engine, having grown up as a kid and hearing many of them in the area. I can recognize the sound of that engine, and if I could hear it, I would run out and try to find it. And again, I was down to the Negro Air Show one day with a couple of guys, and Jim Jackson was that day, and I had my Barra hat on, and we were just behind a rope that I'd say to the people watching it from the aircraft. They started up the aircraft another time where it started correctly, and they were turning the aircraft around, and as they did that, the tail gunner position or the rail of the rear of the plane was swinging towards us, and the plane was directed out towards the Peterborough airfield. Well, and they did that until they got the right position. They gunned the engine. Well, the backwash from this hotel, the B-17, flying Barra hat, and threw it off, oh, probably 50 or 60 feet over the crowd. So that was my big thrill, getting backwash from a B-17 plane and losing my Barra hat for a while.
That's pretty cute, actually. At least you lost it to a good cause. Freedom is noisy, you know?
The one in Peterborough that comes in there, it's something lady, that lucky lady or something like that. And they have a complete B-17 radio equipment installed and restored. They have the, those little, what are they called? I think Don's got one of them in his house. Those little antenna tuning units, little transmitter units. I think they have a BC-610 receiver, and everything is lined up there and ready to go equipment. I don't think they use it for the actual flight. They have some other equipment in the pilot area that they do. But the complete radio section on the B-17 has been restored, and if you go there, you'll recognize the equipment. What's the number of that little square transmitter that you use on the B-17? I know you've got one around the house someplace.
Arc 5, right?
Yes, Arc 5, sir. I think the receiver was a probably BC-348. BC-610 was a big boom transmitter. I don't think they used they used a dynamo to power some of that stuff, because the electrical system on the plane is 24 volts, and they used the dynamo to create, they had to set up so they had the filaments for 24 volts, and then they had the dynamo was used to make the B+, and the way the Arc 5 was, which I have one downstairs now, they used two 1625 tubes in the final, which is a 12-volt version of the 807, has a 6-pin base instead of a 5-pin base, and those two filaments were in series, and then they had a 1626 and a 1629. I think the 1629 was the magic eye tube for crystal calibration, and they had a 1626 was the oscillator, one of the other, I think it's which was which, and they had an oscillator, and basically I still have that down there, and I still make contact with the thing, although it's been modified a bit to it's not exactly original, of course, they would want to have it in a classic environment like an airplane like that. In fact, in that W2JK.
Yeah, as Don can recall, immediately after the war, those little Mark 5s were buying by the carload. they were so inexpensive that every hand had one at least, and they had it on one band or another. The interesting thing I noticed that on the 1B-15 that, a few years back when you could walk through the plane for a $5 charge, they had a little generator mounted in the back of the 17, a regular gas-powered generator. It wasn't mounted, but it was bolted down. They explained that in some airports, in the military, some airports didn't have power to control or whatever else they were using. How to operate the electricity system in the airplane. So they actually carry their own little generator, gas power generator, that they can pull out, set up, hook into the airplane. In the event that there was no power when they landed at a remote airport, really neat. I've got some very nice pictures of this one trip I did on the B-15. Again, a tourist trip on the ground, not in the air.
KG2QIF.
Go ahead, Sal. Peter, go ahead.
Yeah, it was interesting listening to Don's explanation of that radio. A buddy of mine who was a ham when I was a kid growing up, a little older than me. His call sign was WB2VIV, and his name was Al. He had an ARC-5 transmitter for, I believe, 80 meters. He built the crystal oscillator. All that stuff was in the ARRL handbook. And I used my Helicraft, his SX-110, as the receiver, and he came up to my house to operate because he was down the fifth floor and I was up on the 12th floor, and we can actually put a long wire antenna up on the roof from my window, and gave us some output. So, I mean, he was operating on that thing and tapping away. We even had a surplus straight key and making contacts in different parts of the United States. And made the big thrill was making a contact in England and France a few times, and probably most of Europe, but we never met anything further than that. And that was a lot of fun. Now, Don, if I can go direct or ask you the question, I was just always curious about what was the peak output on CW of that thing. And also, I understand that they certainly used them in AM phone mode, and I guess they had modulators or some kind of device to give it to AM access. How much output did these things have?
I'm not sure, Peter. I mean, I know a 1625 is an 807, and you could run. We used to figure that at 807 could run 75 watts input, but I don't think they ran them that hard. Remember, there was two of them there, and I don't think they used that much voltage on them. I think maybe if they had. I think they might have had like 40 watts with them. And they did have a modulator, and that was an external device, the transmitter itself. And the one I have is the original 3 to 4 megahertz DC-696. It has was originally an 80 meter rig to begin with. Now, a lot of the there was another model. It was a 4 to 5.3, I think it was. And those could be tweaked down into the 80 meter band. And then there was a 5.3 to 7, and those guys creeped up to 40. And I think there was something in the 40 meter band that was also from the 40 meter band. Now I have a receiver, an R5 receiver called a BC455. That was 6 to 9.1 megahertz for 40. It was good for 40 meters. And, of course, all the shortwave bands. And we used that as a receiver, and we also used it as the IF on a 2-meter converter, along with the SCR-522, which is a 2-meter AM transmitter from that era. Back to that, WTJK.
Okay, very good, Don. Not too sure. I'm just looking on the web pages for the air show at Teterboro, and I think it's going to be September 15th, which is, again, around the weekend. It can't be September 15th. Anyway, this might be an old post, so I'm not sure about that, but it'll probably be in the pages when it comes along. But it's usually at the end of August or the early part of September that they have the Teterboro air show. Yeah, this one says 2004. They posted a number of the years when they showed some pictures, some preview shows, but I don't see 2009 specified on any of these. Anyway, it's something I probably will go to because I enjoy looking at FB-17 and hearing those engines. Okay, well, any comments or questions or information? We've had an interesting discussion that year, I think we all enjoyed it, but any other questions or comments about what people think, please come out with them.
2 Delta Echo November.
Okay, Echo up Delta Echo November. Denver, go ahead.
I've got a question for Don. Now, one of my favorite receivers is an ARC-5 receiver. I just like how small and compact they are. But I got a capacitor an R5 3-gain capacitor that I got from a friend of mine to make a little tiny 3-tube superhead with an RF amp mixer and IF amp in it. And they have this spline drive kind of connector on the output shaft of the capacitor. Now, I just want to know, on your receiver, how do you go about tuning it with a knob, or did you do some type of mechanism that converts that spline drive to a regular 1/4 shaft?
Okay, the R5 was a remote receiver. It was a remote receiver in the aircraft, and what they had was like a flexible cable, and it attached to the front of the receiver, and then they actually had a remote head, just like your modern radios have today. They, you know, have the remote head in the cord, so you can mount the radio in the trunk of your car and have the remote head on the up by the dashboard. This was basically the same idea, except there was two radios, and this was a tuning control. And there is a box out there made for this. It was part of the ARC-5 series of equipment. Now, people did make tuning knobs for these. These were made, I guess, so many of these were on the war surplus market. People did make them, and somehow the one that my father bought does have a tuning knob on it, right on it. So that's what we had to do to match up with the spline. I don't know what to tell you offhand right now. I think you're looking at some kinks in the old books. Maybe I can find some ideas for you and see what I can find about that substitute, because I don't imagine, unless there's a place like Fair Radio Sales out in Lima, Ohio, might have knobs for that yet. I don't think so, but you can at least try and see what the response would be. Back to you, Henry.
I have found on eBay and stuff a lot of the receivers, just people like made like with plastic tubing that they would just flip over the spline and then put it on a 1/4 like shaft or dowel or something. But I have seen very, very rarely is an actual local control knob that actually fit right onto the actual R5. It had a little collar that you would screw right onto the collar that's on the radio, and it fit right onto the spline shaft. But they usually go for a lot of money on eBay, and they're very, very rare. So I haven't been able to find anyone or anything for it. But usually, I have a little shaft extension that I just kind of snugly put on and put a 1/4 shaft into it. But I feel like I'm hurting the actual spline drive. I think I'm going to try the tubing trick where you slide tubing over it and then over the 1/4 shaft. And hopefully that'll get me where I need to be.
This W2JEK, yeah, that would work. And, yeah, some of the prices, I guess, would be pretty exorbitant on eBay for something like that. What my father did with this one, well, of course, there are certain modifications you have to do. Again, on the front panel, it was a place for the BFO switch. The B-frequency oscillator switch could be on or off. He mounted a little panel there. He mounted the switch there, and he mounted a volume control, and he mounted a B plus on and off switch. Now, in the back of those radios, there was a place where there was a little dynamo. Well, that we didn't have, and we didn't need it because it was 28 volts input to make the 300 volts, and we didn't have a source of 28 volts. In those days, the cars had 6-volt batteries in them, and we didn't use them mobile. So what he did, he wired the filaments in series, and then he put a resistor in a little box with some perforations at the top of it, and in series with it. So it was like the old AC-DC sets. You could plug the filaments
They were all in series, and I had this resistor, a dropping resistor in series with the whole thing, so that it would be the proper voltage. And that didn't, and then he had another pair of wires came out to a power supply for the, used about 250 volts, or there about 200 volts or whatever you can get in that neck of the woods, for the B-plus supply. And that's the way we have that. Back to you, Devin, W2JK.
That sounds really, really cool. No, I would love to see that. You can arrange one kit and I see you bring that in and show me a little bit more about it, because I really like R5s, and I've always been trying to find one on, like, eBay to try to repair. And I know that there's a bunch of different models that do different frequency ranges. And I know one of the rarer ones was the R5 that does the broadcast from, like, 500 kilohertz to, like, 1.7 megahertz. And I know those used to be used to tune for, like, a, I think, a low wave frequency, so long wave frequency. One used to be used for, as, like, a tunable IF thing. So back to you.
Yeah, I think it's a PC-450. I have a PC-455. That's 6 to 9.1. There's a PC-454 that took in the 80 meter band. I think that was about 3 to 6 megahertz. And the PC-453 was from 190 to 550 kilohertz. And what guys would do with that is they would tune it to 455 kilohertz and put a wire, just a very small capacitor, into the 455 kilohertz IF of their receiver, and feed it into this PC-453 and take the audio out after it went through the PC-453. Now, the PC-453 has an 85 kilohertz IF stages, and what that does, it has very sharp selectivity compared to the 455. So it was a godsend. They called it a Q5 because it would have been an impossible contact, a solid contact. Back to you,
Jeff. Yeah, I go online to the AWRL, and they have all these articles that are in the archives online, that all you do is you download them as a PDF file, and you can read them. And I go around looking at all the old, like, things they used to publish. And I just love all that tube stuff, and I love regen radios, single conversion, superhets, all that kind of stuff. And I built quite a bit of it, too.
Well, that's great that you've done some building. That's great. Yeah, I've done some building in my time with kits and stuff from scratch and all that. I started when I built a transmitter when I was 11 years old, living in an apartment in Staten Island when we didn't even have an antenna or a receiver to go with it or anything else. But, I still have that, believe it or not. Back to you, W2JK.
That's really pretty cool. So maybe we'll continue this talk at midnight one week, and I'll pass it back over to Tony if he's still there. All right, back to Tony.
It's doing great. You can continue if you wish. But let me just suggest that as the official Bergen Amateur Eagle Association principal, that I'm going to bow out as the control, and I thank him. K2DEN, W2JK, KC2QIM for checking in tonight. I will send a report to Bob Javits for check-in. And I'll let you guys talk some more. But Don Denver has built some very nice equipment. He brought a piece in the kid night while we were over at Western High School early in the year, and he did a beautiful job of layout and assembly and mechanical structure. So maybe one of those days he can show you some of his work. So back to the net and leave everybody else free running if you wish. Don, if you want to pick it up, or let me throw it back to Don, and I'm going to bow out. K2AMI clear of the net, but leaving the frequency open.